First Peter 3. Today we're going to consider two alternatives suggested in a passage in chapter 3 of First Peter. If you've been with us in this study, you know the context for this passage, which I think is very important. He's been arguing with this group of Christians who are under intense persecution that when they're thinking about how should we respond to the fact that the community and the government is persecuting us, imprisoning us, and so forth, that the key is to be an underground movement and not to draw a lot of hostile attention on yourself through your behavior or through your attitude toward other people. He says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. So when you get slandered, they'll realize through your behavior that you're not that bad, and they'll accept you. And this then followed into a number of specific recommendations, including going so far as to say even slaves should just submit to their masters, including the unreasonable masters, not just the good ones. We saw last week it wasn't a matter where Peter is pro-slavery. It's just a matter that they're not in any position to try to lead some kind of slave revolt, and that if they're already under persecution and slaves who were accepted into Christian fellowship as equals by the Christians, and this aroused suspicion on the part of the Romans and Greeks that this could lead to a slave revolt, because they would never even socialize with slaves, but the Christians would welcome them into fellowship and call them brother and sister. Then when the slave comes home and has an attitude problem with his master, it's going to greatly increase the suspicion, and this is when they start to retaliate and try to crush Christianity. And so he's saying, you know, the best thing to do is just do what they tell you to do and just stay out of trouble. And that brings us up to the end of chapter 2. He says, actually, you should submit to every governing institution. And we saw that the main governing institution in power at this time was Nero, the wicked, evil Roman emperor that's so notorious in history. And he's saying, look, just do what they tell you to do and hope that they leave us alone. And this logic then carries directly into chapter 3. Remember that the chapter breaks are not in the original text. These were added hundreds of years later by people whose opinion is really hard to discern why they even put them there in some cases. And this is one of those, because it's all part of the same train of thought. And he says in the first verse, in the same way, showing us that he's still thinking about avoiding persecution. And in this case, he says, in the same way, wives should submit to their own husbands. Here's what it says in verse 1 and 2. In the same way, you wives should be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. So you can see how similar the thinking is right through this section, including this passage. But then, too, when we read this about the idea of wives submitting to their husbands, clearly this is an ancient text and was written in a patriarchal age where the expectation was very strong that wives have to obey their husbands, that the husband is the head of the household. And he's saying, wives, you need to go along with that, because for the same reason, so often the wives might become Christian believers and not the husband. Then if the wife is going out to these meetings with Christians and the husband, who has all the power in that society, is suspicious of what she's doing, then she comes home and starts giving him an attitude problem and, you know, won't comply with his wishes, that's just going to really bring the heat down even more on the Christian community. So I think we understand the thinking here. He's concerned that they be able to win their husbands over, which is not going to be done by fighting them, but which is more likely to happen if the husband has the perception that my wife is, you know, more cooperative now than she's ever been. And so this Christian thing she's into seems like it's having a good effect. Still, it raises a lot of problems for modern readers to look at a text right in the Bible that's talking about wives submitting to their husbands. That is, in the mind of many feminist scholars, proof right there that the Bible itself is patriarchal, that Peter backs this system 100%, and that it's yet one more example of the exploitation of women and trying to keep women down under the heel of men in the name of religion. I'd like to take that proposition on today and think about it, because I think that that's understandable. I've spent a lot of time on, you know, my major is history, and even in graduate school I studied historical theology and comparative religion, so I've spent a lot of time reading feminist historical research and why feminists today feel that patriarchy is maybe one of the most dominant themes in the history of the human race, often and usually backed and validated through religion, including Christianity. Now, we hear a lot of commentary today from Christian thinkers that's kind of bitter and negative about feminist research and the idea that feminists just have a chip on their shoulder and they're, you know, quacks and bitter women, and that, you know, the whole thing is greatly exaggerated, that they just want to be rebellious and that's their problem. Well, let's think through that. This term, patriarchy, the rule of the father, it is an ideology which defends men's right to dominate the women around them. In patriarchy, it's male dominance. And in most societies, the way patriarchy works out, it's the husband ruling over the wife, it's the father ruling over all the women in his household. If the husband dies, then she comes under the rulership of a different man, the in-laws, the grandparents, or her older brothers become rulers over her. But that the woman is always kept as a ward of males and is never allowed, really, to develop her own life, her own powers. I believe it is a fact that weak men are easily threatened by strong women. I've observed this my whole life. I was raised in a household with a mother who was a very strong woman. And it was always interesting to me to watch the interaction of other men, especially in the churches we used to attend. My mother was a very gifted speaker and teacher of the scriptures, and she was asked to speak in people's homes for home Bible studies. She started an organization that grew to several hundred women called Layman's Challenge that would come and hear her speak every week. She had literally dozens of these home Bible studies that typically had 20, 30 adults sitting in the living room listening to her lecture. And these were spread all over town. And during this whole time, there were hundreds and hundreds of people involved, and many of them met Christ through her ministry. During that whole time, she was never asked to speak at the church we went to. And in fact, the weak male leadership there was obviously terrified of her and her powers. And I always was just fascinated by that. Because, I mean, here they had a member in that church who was obviously probably more gifted than the pastor himself or anyone else that they had to teach there, but they focused on was trying to keep her shut up. And it was just so obvious to me that they were intimidated by this strong female. In history, we find that patriarchy is that the feminists are not lying or exaggerating. That patriarchy is a real and provable theme that dominates history, and that it's typically backed and fostered by religious thinking. For example, in oral religions, you know, tribal religions, they're almost invariably paternalistic and repressive of women. There's over 6,000 identifiable oral religions in the world, so there's way too much detail to consider here. But, you know, think of the example we talked about earlier, where in many fertility religions, animism, they practice ritual prostitution. That's a typical example of the exploitation of women in the name of religion, where a young girl is devoted to the cultus as a lifelong prostitute, a sex slave, and men ravish this girl until she dies, which is typically very young, in order to promote fertility, in order to practice sympathetic magic and make the gods breed and cause fertility in the fields and in people's wombs. It's a miserable life, and the girl has no say in it. If she gets pregnant, she's summarily aborted, and this is why they usually die before they get very old. Let's think of Judaism. Quoting here from the Talmud. The Talmud is not the Bible. The Bible is called Torah in Judaism. The Talmud is the commentary on the Torah, but the Talmud today in Judaism and for hundreds of years has come to have more control, more prominence in how Judaism works than the Torah itself, because this is considered the more or less infallible guide to how to interpret the Old Testament. In the Talmud, we read, the woman is the origin of sin, and it's through her that we all die. Do not leave a leaky cistern to drip or allow a bad wife to say what she likes. If she does not accept your control, divorce her and send her away. For out of the clothes comes the moth, and out of woman comes woman's wickedness. And you know, I don't know whether you've ever studied divorce in the ancient world, but divorce was a really cruel fate for a woman. Because a man could divorce a woman for any reason, and there was no social security, there was no alimony, there was no child care. Indeed, even her children wouldn't go with her unless the man wanted them to. If he wanted to keep them and throw her out, he had the power to do that. And so when a woman was divorced and set out, no one wanted her anymore. She had no education. She had no means of support. And often, you know, things like prostitution were the only way to survive. It was a very cruel fate to be divorced in the ancient world. The Talmud says, better a man's wickedness than a woman's goodness. It's woman who brings shame and disgrace. Those types of sentiments are what feminist scholars call misogyny, the hatred of woman, these kind of bitter attitudes toward women. And you see this written right in the scriptures of the major world religions. A woman may be divorced, according to Hillel, for any reason whatsoever. To divorce a woman, you face her and say, I divorce thee, I divorce thee, I divorce thee. That's it. She's out. No court of appeal. Nothing she can do about it. The husband could reject her if she accidentally served him food that had been slightly burned, or if at home she talked so loud that the neighbor could hear. Those were specific cases cited for things that would justify a divorce. In Hinduism, let's go to the East, regions of the East. In later Hinduism, a widow was prohibited from mentioning any man's name but that of her deceased husband. So if your husband died, you're never allowed to say the name of another man other than your dead husband. A woman, a widow in Hindu society was in a pitiful situation. She was expected to continue her reverence for her husband for the rest of her life, even though he's dead now. Even if she had been a child bride or had never consummated her marriage, very common in that society, the widow was not to violate her duty to her deceased husband and remarry. If she did, she would bring disgrace on herself in the present life and enter the womb of a jackal for her next rebirth. This is total patriarchy and control of women even beyond the grave. In such a social position, many widows must have felt they had little to lose by throwing themselves on the husband's funeral pyre. That's a Hindu practice called suti, where the woman, when her husband dies, would have herself bound to a stake and burned in the same funeral pyre that they burn the body of her dead husband. Very common in ancient times and right up to the modern era. It's still practiced in India, although it's illegal now, mainly under the influence of legislation brought in from the West under the British, who outlawed it. Even suti, though, is not simple. If the widow did not burn herself out of pure conjugal love, her act was without merit. and she could still experience a very poor reincarnation. In Hindu society, women were not eligible for moksha. The best that a woman could hope for was to be reborn as a man. They can't go to heaven. They have to first graduate up to the higher level of being a man, and then they can go to heaven in reincarnation. These comments, by the way, are all from Carmody and Carmody in their book, Ways to the Center, a very sympathetic treatment of world religions. As you can tell from the title, Ways to the Center, they view all religions as being equally valid, different ways to the center, to God. And yet, you know, you have to tell the truth. And they make some fairly incisive observations about patriarchy in different world religions. To ritualize her attitude of devotion to her husband, Orthodox Hindu authors counseled wives to adore the big toe of their husband's right foot, bathing it as they would an idol and offering incense before it as they would a great god. Serious. This really has happened. His right toe. Just bowing to his toe. Utter subservience. You see the attitude behind this. The birth of a girl was not an occasion for joy. Hindus attributed it to bad karma in a previous life and frequently announced the event by saying, nothing was born. Infanticide of female offspring. So common in India and today, still today. So common, for instance, in China, where the one-child rule has led families to commit infanticide, to kill female infants in such great numbers that the ratio of men to women in China today is approaching 2-to-1, because they don't want female offspring, only males. Manu's view was that women are as impure as falsehood itself. In fact, Manu counseled the wise never to sit with a woman in a lonely place, even if that woman be one's mother, sister, or daughter. You believe that? And that is what is called misogyny, the hatred of women. What a bitter attitude toward women that really is. Even if it's your mother or your daughter, that you should only speak to them in a public setting, never be sitting alone with them. Hindu religious texts frequently imagine women as a snake, as hell's entrance, death, a prostitute, or an adulteress. In Manu's code, slaying a woman was one of the minor offenses, lower than theft. Well, what about Islam? A huge proportion of the world today lives under Islam. What does it say about women? Quoting here from the Quran itself, your women are a tillage for you, so come into your tillage as often as you wish. You know what it is to till a field. Tillage is your field. And he's saying that they're your field that you own, and you can go plow that field anytime you want. It's kind of a low view of women, frankly. Men are the managers of the affairs of women, for that God has preferred in bounty one of them over another, and for that they have expended of their property. They had to pay money to get their wives in a dowry. Righteous women, therefore, are obedient, guarding the secret for God's guarding, and those you fear may be rebellious, admonish, banish them to their couches and beat them. The Quran, Surah 4:34. These are the actual scriptures that we're quoting, not later commentators' point of view. For many men, the best part of heavenly garden, heaven, is the boor, dark-eyed, buxom virgins. In addition to his earthly wife, each male in heaven could expect to have 70 boor. They would never be sick, menstruating, pregnant, unless he wanted them to be, bad-tempered, or jealous. He would be able to deflower 1,000 boor each month and find them all intact when he returned to them. Well, needless to say, the women don't get any corresponding collection of male studs to hang out with. This is kind of a male religion. Let's go to China. Here's what Carmody and Carmody comment about China and Chinese religion. The Chinese ritual of foot binding was a thousand-year-old horror show in which women were grotesquely crippled from early childhood. The hideous 3-inch-long lotus hooks, which in reality are odoriferous, useless stumps, were the means by which the Chinese patriarchs saw to it that their girls and women would never run around. Then in Confucianism, they comment that Confucianism was largely misogynistic. The woman's role in Confucianism was to obey and serve her parents, her husband, and her husband's parents. She was useless until she produced a male heir. These are just typical, you know, I'm just picking a few selections. Frankly, this kind of reading, these types of attitudes are so widespread, you could sit here all day and for many days reading similar comments. A Chinese woman was primarily her husband's source of sons. The ideal Chinese woman was retiring, silent, and fertile. Female infanticide was common, as it still is today. That's the ideal woman in paternalistic thinking. Christianity, finally, a word of sanity. Let's get some balance in here. Well, I wish it were, but I'm afraid not. Here's early church father Jerome. If we abstain from coitus, we honor our wives. If we do not abstain, well, what's the opposite of honor but insult? Of course, the medieval church had a horribly negative view of sexuality and viewed it as a weakness, as something that was carnal. Even within marriage, they often argued that if you're so weak as a man that you feel like you have to get married, then do so, but the best thing is a celibate marriage where you never engage in sex. Jerome says, as long as a woman is for birth and children, she's as different from a man as a body is from soul. But when she wishes to serve Christ more than the world, then she'll cease to be a woman and will be called a man. So women are always carnally minded, and if any of them are really spiritual and want to serve God, then they get the honor of being called a man at that point. Tertullian, the famous early father, says, "Do you not know," speaking to women, "do you not know that each of you women is also an Eve? You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You are the one who persuaded him who the devil was too weak to attack. How easily you destroyed man, the image of God. Because of the death which you brought upon us, even the Son of God had to die." Misogyny, bitter attitude toward women. How different his commentary is from what the Bible teaches, right? Who does the Bible blame for eating the forbidden fruit? Read Romans 5. Read the other passages. Always Adam. Adam was the one that was to blame. And there's never any suggestion that, you know, it's interesting here. He says, you destroyed him who was created in the image of God. But Genesis 1 is very clear. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them both. They were both in the image of God. But Tertullian has separated out men from women and said only man is in the image of God. John Damascene says, a woman is a wicked she-ass, a hideous tapeworm, the advanced post of hell. Ambrose says, she who does not believe is a woman and should be designated by the name of her sex, whereas she who believes progresses to perfect manhood, to the measure of adulthood of Christ. She then dispenses with the name of her sex. This type of commentary is so commonplace and so widespread in the leadership of the church, it's really amazing. Pope Gregory refers to how women are slow in understanding. And he refers to her unstable and naive mind, her natural mental weakness, and her need of an authoritative husband. A woman so defective, so deficient, the only help for her is to have a nice, strong man who can dominate her. That's what she needs. Patriarchy, the rule of the pater, the father's rule. It's rife throughout all of these religious complexes, and frankly, it's very difficult to find any that don't teach it. St. Thomas Aquinas. It was necessary for a woman to be made as a helpmate for man, indeed, as a help, not as a help in some other work, as some maintain, because in fact, in any other work, a man can be more efficiently helped by another man than by a woman, but as a help in the work of regeneration. That's patriarchy. There's the belief of woman basically not useful for much of anything other than having children. This is what bothers feminist scholars when they go and read religious literature. Do you wonder why? Is it any surprise that a lot of women view religion as the enemy of women? I think it's not an exaggeration. It's not a surprise. Aquinas goes on concerning the conception of a female child. He says, woman is misbegotten and defective, for the active force in the male seed tends to the production of a perfect likeness in the masculine sex, while the production of a woman comes from a defect in the active force, or from some material indisposition, or even from an external influence, such as that of a south wind, which is moist. Any of these hazards could result in the misfortune of the birth of a woman. And so, I've just given you a rasher of samples. Historical Christianity cannot wash its hands of anything any more than any of the others, and frankly, they're all alike. And this is the kind of material that feminist historians bring forward in huge reams. These are not obscure texts or atypical texts. These are the norm. And I think as Christians today, a lot of Christians who I've heard being very bellicose about how evil and false feminism is, need to do some reading. And frankly, we often show our ignorance with those kind of comments. I think the feminists have a very good point, and in fact, that this theme of patriarchy is one of the most dominant themes in the history of humanity, and particularly in the case of religion. Religion has rarely been the friend of women, and people try to cite examples today of goddess worship, arguing that goddess worship is better for women. That's very rarely the case as well. In fact, the very cultists that we were talking about with earlier with the ritual prostitution, that was goddess worship, Aphrodite, where they had the 1,000 temple priestesses, so-called, who are really ritual prostitutes. The cases of any religions that are favorable to women are, in fact, rare. Patriarchy, I would argue, is a violent evil. And it's not an exaggeration put forward by feminist thinkers. In fact, Christians, men and women, should join the fight against ungodly patriarchy. I wish we could really get into this subject in a deep way from the Bible itself, because the Bible is dead set against this mentality. There's no warrant for it there. And Jesus, of all people, had a remarkable attitude toward women. He had women, disciples and followers. You know, a remarkable case with Jesus, for example, when he was teaching the scriptures in the house of Martha and Mary. And Martha, who was preparing the meal, came out and complained to Jesus about her sister who was sitting at his feet listening to the teaching of the scriptures, a position which, according to rabbinic religion of that time, no woman should ever be allowed to be in. The Talmud says it's better to burn the law than to have it fall into the hands of a woman. They did not believe in teaching women the scriptures because they were too naive and ignorant to handle it, and it's over their head and it should be reserved for men. Jesus was teaching, and Mary was sitting in that teaching. When Martha came out and complained to him and said, "Tell my sister to come back and help with the service of the food," that would be exactly where she belonged, according to religious and social thinking of that day. Yes, she should be in the kitchen while the men folks study the deep things of God out here. Jesus replied, "Mary has chosen the better part." He says, "Very few things are necessary, including the meal. She has chosen the better part. It will not be taken from her." And he adamantly stood that she may sit here and teach. So this point, I think we need to understand the reality of a real problem here in historical thinking, and it's still present with us today. But it's on the wane in the Western world, and in its place, though, I'm afraid we're developing a new perspective, which I'm not sure is going to be any better. In fact, I think it'll be just as bad, where we've gone to a radical extreme in the other direction. Today, we live with the postmodern no submission thesis. In postmodern thinking, to submit to any other person is an admission that that person is superior to you and is of higher value than yourself. And this goes in particular for women, that any woman who elects to submit to anyone, particularly to a husband or whatever, is demeaning herself, is denying her value as a person. People instead need to be empowered. That's kind of the battle cry of postmodern thinking, is that people, groups, and particularly oppressed groups need to be empowered, which, as you read and study it, really means that they don't no longer need to submit to anyone. And that is considered to be the path of relief for women and other repressed minority groups. Empowerment. Let's read some feminist theologians. These are Christian theologians. Here's Elizabeth Schussler-Fiorenza. She says, "I would insist that the central spiritual and religious feminist quest is the quest for women's self-affirmation, survival, power, and self-determination." And she goes on to unfold this, explaining that for self-determination and these others to be there, it directly implies the first thing that has to go is biblical patriarchy. As self-identified women, we cannot but leave behind patriarchal biblical religion. Here's Rebecca Gruteis, an evangelical author. That the other gal was more from a liberal theological orientation. Here's Gruteis is an evangelical. She says, "In traditional marriage, the wife's inferiority in function follows justly and logically from her inferiority in being." See what she's saying? In traditional marriage, where the man is supposed to lead, she says, the whole thing is based on the assumption of the inferiority of women. She says, "A woman cannot be served by a man's spiritual rule unless her ability to discern the will and understand the word of God is inferior to the ability God has given men in this regard." So what she's arguing is, what reason would there ever be for submitting to your husband, to his leadership? Only one, and that is an admission of your own personal inferiority. You notice how she refers to male leadership in the home as the husband's rule. And she uses language like that throughout her book, Good News for Women, to cast a pejorative, spin on this whole idea. Well, you can sense that she has essentially the same view as the previous gal, which is that this idea of women submitting is dehumanizing, degrading, and it's an admission of inferiority. I got a number of problems with this radical reaction to patriarchy. I don't think this is the right answer at all. First of all, biblical texts have been misunderstood, like this one in 1 Peter 3. You see the logic for why Peter is saying this, and yes, he is working within a cultural milieu where the expectation was strong that women would follow their husband's leadership. And there are other texts as well that back this idea up for different reasons and give the theology behind it, as we're going to talk about in a minute. But at its heart, in patriarchy, the assumption is that the male is so far superior to the female that this is why she needs a guardian, a controller that can keep her out of trouble, because she's a very simple, foolish being that needs that kind of thing. That's not what the Bible teaches. Here's a text, for instance, in the New Testament, which gives the New Testament perspective on women, where Paul says there is neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free man, there is neither male nor female, because you're all one in Christ. The biblical view is an equality view between male and female. This is a very radical comment to hear in the first century. I can't really think of another piece of literature from that period that would say anything close to what this is saying. I mean, it's hard for the modern reader to appreciate how bizarre this must have been for people. They didn't want to hear this. Nobody believed this. That men and women would be equal before God. That's radical stuff. And Paul taught it here and elsewhere. And so I think that the characterization of the biblical view of women as patriarchal is wrong. Secondly, if you start from the postmodern assumption, you know, that submission is demeaning and suggests inferiority, then you now have no basis for submitting to any person. The only reason why any of us would submit to anyone, to their leadership, to hold ourselves in subjugation to another, would be the admission that that person is so superior to me, I think I should subject myself to them. And I think that that's a very harsh and unreal perspective, actually. Truthfully, we can submit to others, to one another. First of all, the whole New Testament falls to the ground if we accept that postulate. According to the New Testament, over and over again, it says, submit yourselves to one another. Ephesians chapter 5, in humility, submit to one another. Allow others to admonish us, to lead us, to influence us. The biblical idea is a concept of humility, not of self-assertion. So when we take this totally negative view of leadership and submission, we have absolutely gutted any possibility. Now my mission in life becomes, as the one gal said, self-determination and empowerment. And so my whole goal is just to get what I want, and I guess to make other, try to manipulate other people in my direction. What happens when two people with this thesis, this no submission thesis, meet and form a relationship? Now we have two individuals, both determined to get their way, to have self-determination. And what we'll find is that's a formula for disaster in relationship. That in fact, a relationship based on that thesis is going to be a low-key war right from day one. Nothing but a tug of war, a wrestling match between two people to see who gets their way. You know, truthfully, we are different from one another. There's no chance really that two people are just automatically going to want the same thing all the time. That's not the way it works. And so what happens is we insulate ourselves and we kind of go separate ways and lead autonomous lives, resisting constantly the efforts of my spouse or partner to have an influence over me. And the result is pretty predictable, which is alienation. The only way to live this empowered, self-determined life and to avoid any need to submit to anyone else is just to keep everyone at arm's length. And that is a picture of postmodern society. Any relationship where I feel that I'm not getting my way and I'm not self-determined, I'll terminate that relationship. And here we have probably the best explanation for why modern people in the West are unable to put together successful marriages. Close relationships, like a marriage relationship, are the first thing to fall under the no submission thesis. And it's really all friendships have to be kept at an arm's length. Because if we want to draw close together, there has to be a different paradigm that we operate under. And that is what we need to think about today. The biblical radical alternative to the no submission thesis, namely this concept of servant love. Servant love is what Jesus talks about in passages like Mark 10, 42 to 45. Jesus said to them, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them." People love to dominate and control and have power over other people in this world. True enough. He says, "It shall not be so with you. I'm calling you to something different than that." Instead, he says, "Whoever wishes to become great among you should become your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be the slave of all." Turns the concept of leadership on its head. Instead of the leader being the one that gets to dominate, that gets to get his way, that gets to make other people pull my wagon, Jesus says, "I'm here to teach you a different new concept of what leadership means, servant leadership." He says, "Think about me. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." Here was someone in the Son of God who had the power to force people to do what he wanted. He had the power to take what he wanted and compel obedience. He says, "Look at me. Here I am. I've come in a humble form of a carpenter's son. I'm living a life of self-denial and suffering, and I'm about to give my life itself at the cross. I'm going to let people pummel me to death for the salvation of the human race." Think about it. That's the kind of leadership. He says, there's your model. If you want to understand what godly leadership is, it's not the leadership of selfishness like we see in the fallen world. It's the leadership of self-giving and serving, servitude. What a different model this really is. And this brings us to the heart of the dialogue between Bible-believing Christians and postmodern thinkers in general. I don't think biblical Christians are ever going to agree with the postmodern view about submission, because we mean different things when we say leadership. This is what you have to understand. When the Bible talks about the role of males and females in marriage, it's all under this paradigm of servant leadership. And when you don't understand that part, it can sound like patriarchy. Yeah. You have to understand what serving love is all about. In this passage in 1 Peter, we're back to our original text. He says, "Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives." And so the context, as we saw, living in such a way among the pagans that though they accuse you of wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God. Submitting yourself for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men. For example, slaves submitting to your masters. And for example, wives in this same way submitting to your husbands. So in this passage, the issue that Peter's speaking to is the issue of evangelism and avoiding persecution. Evangelism, that your non-Christian, non-believing husband may be won over. He's advising them on tactics and strategy for that. So the primary issue is avoiding unnecessary persecution and winning husbands to Christ. Now, on the other hand, other passages do teach that there's a different role for male and female on different grounds, on theological grounds. For instance, in Ephesians 5, he says the same thing, that women should submit to their husbands. And so it is a biblical teaching that God establishes, wants to establish in a marriage, the man as the head of the household. As startling as that may be to the modern, postmodern reader, that's what it says. But, again, have we understood what that really means? For instance, he goes on in the next verse and says, the husband's role is to love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. That's referring to Jesus' own teaching, right? Not that the spirit of the Gentiles where you get to lord it over your following. But like me, if you want to be great, then you have to be the servant of all. And the men are being called here, if you want to be the leader in your marriage, that means you get to be the first to sacrifice. You get to be the first one to get nailed to the cross for the sake of your wife. You get to be the first one to give up your way for God's way. The role of leader in the biblical paradigm is not a self-aggrandizing and self-glorifying role. It's servant leadership. And that means, frankly, if my wife wants a turn at being the servant leader in our home, she can have that any time she wants. Go right ahead. In Christian thinking, leadership is not a privilege. It's a responsibility. It's a duty to initiate self-sacrifice in that relationship. And Peter reflects this too. Here we are back in 1 Peter 3. Look down in verse 7. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives, treating them with respect as the weaker vessel. The term vessel used right through the New Testament referring to their body. This is talking about not that they're more ignorant than you or more simple than you, but rather that they're physically weaker, a fact which even some feminists will reluctantly admit. That in general, most men are larger and stronger than the same population of women. The point being that often in these patriarchal societies, the woman had to do all the heavy work. It was the woman that had to go out and, you know, carry the water and do all the house and everything else. And often women, and even when they were, you know, pregnant or just had a kid and stuff, and women were often broken by the harsh work imposed on them by their patriarchal men. And Peter's forbidding this. He's saying, men, you need to treat them with respect and realize you are stronger than her, and you need to take more of a hand in that household work. And he says to treat them as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life so that nothing will hinder your prayers. They're fellow heirs. They're equals before God. Heirs are those who will inherit the kingdom just like you will. He says you need to remember this. This is the princess that you're living with. And if you don't, he says, your prayers will be hindered. God will not listen to your prayers because you're acting too carnally. He says, finally, all of you live in harmony with one another, being sympathetic, love as brothers, be compassionate and humble. In other words, this whole ethos of being willing to submit to one another rather than to brashly assert our rights and our self-determination, that's just the biblical way. And if you don't understand that backdrop, it's impossible to understand these statements about leadership. So this is the real issue. Are we going to strive with one another for power and rights, or are we going to adopt Christ's posture of humility and love? The Christian believer who follows Jesus' way is eager to see other people empowered. We're into empowering others and not gaining our own power. I thought this was an interesting clip from a gal here in our fellowship who was deeply steeped in feminist ideology. I'll let her tell you about it.
I majored in women's studies. I graduated from Ohio State University with a degree from the Department of Women's Studies. My background in growing up had a very large effect on how I viewed men and women, since my mother was a single mom, and my dad and her had gotten divorced at such a, you know, when I was only a few months old. I didn't really grow up with a male figure in my house other than my brother. Men were always absent. When my mom had gotten a boyfriend and had him move in with us, I was probably like, 4 years old. From the time I was four to the time I was like 6 or 7, we lived in a very sexually abusive home. So I had that abuse, the dad who left, and the men throughout my life that started the view, started my view on, a poor view on men. Especially with just that I thought that they treated women poorly. And I saw how my mom had been like this doting woman who just wanted to care for her children. And I that's when I very much viewed that as weak. Like, I saw her and she was weak, and look how she was treated. I would call myself a Christian feminist. I definitely, my view of feminism has changed over the years. Feminism to me is a lot about equality for people. Being a Christian puts that in such a more beautiful term to me. Like, I think that God is basically had that same idea. You know, he never intended for women to be treated beneath men at all. The women around me in my field of study had a lot of bitterness issues toward how, what the Bible represented or what they thought the Bible represented. I know I had a lot of misconceptions, and I thought that that pretty much ran rampant. Our professor actually talked specifically about Paul, and that Paul could be attributed to a lot of the way society had set up discrimination towards women, or the way they had set up how women should be treated. Whether or not that was taken out of context or not was irrelevant. I mean, it was basically, it had been taken, you know, Paul was just noted as being the guy behind, he's basically the father of discrimination for women, I guess. I started wondering if that thing, that was true, you know, was this really true? And I had a very distinct view of the Bible. I had felt that it was a good storybook, even though I really had never read it. I was like fed up, so I'm like, okay, someone's got to sit down and tell me. Is Paul a chauvinist? Is he the father of chauvinism? I think that people were almost shocked. I think people, I frightened people when I first started coming around, because I was so aggressive and very much like, I am woman, hear me roar. But I was just really mad. I mean, I was really mad. I was mad at God. I was mad at Paul. I was mad at everyone. If you were male, I was mad. Well, I had started coming to a Tuesday night home church, I was very much like, after the teaching, people would just come up to me and ask me, like, what did you think? And I was really willing to tell them, you know, this is what I thought. So I would start dialoguing with people, and they would, if they didn't know the answer, they'd come back and tell me, you know, well, I don't know. Let me look at that. Let me look it up. So they come back, and I would make them prove it to me. I had a lot of people who were really willing, and it was almost scarily excited about answering my questions. It actually freaked me out at times, but most of the time I just thought, oh, they're kind of cool. A lot of my views changed about Paul, you know, the more I researched him. And I started to think that there might be a possibility that he was okay. And I would keep running, you know, Galatians 3:28 through my head over and over and over. There's again, neither Greek nor Jew, there's neither slave nor free man, there's neither male nor female, for you all one in Christ Jesus. That was a very freeing verse for me. I mean, that was like my call to, you know, my call home from the Lord, you know. Like, I really felt like God was telling me through that verse and through other verses that I had never intended for my word to be used against you. You know, it was never meant to harm you. It is equality, true equality for women. God wants us to treat each other in a loving way. And discriminating against each other is the farthest thing from loving. I had gone to a place eventually where I was accepting of Paul, and I started feeling very much like he was an all right guy. But when it came to marriage, I drew the line. I did not want to hear anything Paul had to say about marriage. when I started to really understand what traits God had put into me, what qualities, characteristics, and that sort of thing, that has now become one of the things that I love. Like, I love the fact that God's made me a nurturer. I love the fact that He's made me more sensitive. I love the fact that, you know, my husband comes to me for that quality. You know, I love the fact that he relies on me to help him where he stops, you know, emotionally. You know, I think it's a great strength, but before I thought, yuck. When you're growing up through life and you think things are off and you just never know exactly what they are or why something's wrong, that is, I think a lot of what God offered me was answering those questions. But before God, before I really let God answer those questions for me, I think feminism offered me a way to theorize that and sort of understand it, but it never offered me a solution. It never offered me a way to practice, you know, equality. And I think God definitely gives you that. He gives you the whole framework.
Wow, cool. I don't really have time to get into this the rest of the way today. We're out of time, but let's just remember this attitude of submission. It's an attitude, not an action. It's different than obedience. Sometimes it's necessary to refuse to comply with directives because they're wrong. And I wish I had time to unfold that more, but this is not an unqualified, it's never an unqualified call to do whatever you're told. Whether it's a wife to a husband, whether it's us to the governing authorities, or, you know, church leaders, or anything like that. If you study leadership and following in the Bible, it's always qualified. And also, let's just remember that men are equally called to be submissive, just like women are. So there is no difference in that regard. It all has to do with that ethos of humility. What is your opportunity here in response to what I'm saying? The key is, first of all, to experience the servant love of God. This is what I think she was saying opens the door to understanding this servant view of love, is letting God's love come into your life. You ought to think about that. Jesus said, to anyone that opens the door, I will come in to your life. And if you open the door to God and say, show me what, I'm tired of being a self-assertive, alienated person. I want to understand what real love is, and show me your love. That's where it all begins. Then as you experience the power of humble love, submissiveness begins to lose its revulsion. Because we see, just like she was saying, you know, this is not disgusting. It's not something that's going to ruin my life, but rather it frees me and opens me to a true expression of love. Growing Christians learn that gaining power for me is not the answer in our relationships. What she was saying in her clip was really true, and I bet she's got a healthy marriage because she basically has gotten away from the self-assertive empowerment theory for me and has gotten into Jesus' willingness to be the servant of all. And that is the key for closeness in relationships, which is really what we want. That's really what we need in our lives. And we're going to have to draw the line right there. I wonder if anyone has a thought, a question, or maybe some experience of your own to share with us here before we pray.
Well, I wonder if you can comment on Genesis 3:16, where, you know, God said to the woman, you know, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth, etc. Then yet he goes down here, yet your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you.
Okay, Genesis 3:15, a text that is situated after the fall of the human race, when God comes and pronounces certain judgments on humans as a result of this fall. Most of these, if you look at them, are statements of fact that this is the way it is, not really an expression of the moral will of God. For example, to the man, he says, from now on you shall get your food by the sweat of your brow. The ground will bring forth thorns and thistles, and it'll be very difficult. Work is going to become odious. And it's not an instruction that we should never use weed killer or try to resist the effects of the fall, but rather God is saying, this is the consequence of your throwing my leadership off and taking over for yourself. You're not going to be able to control your world anymore, and you're alienated from your own environment. Likewise, with the woman, he predicts that men will rule over her. And it's not formulated necessarily as a statement of, and I think that's a good thing, because none of the things that he mentions in that list are good things. Like her pain in childbearing. Yes, we take anesthesia for childbearing. And I think it's more of a prediction of God that this is what the fallen world is going to be like, including domination by men over women.
I think in our culture, there's still a lot of, even with the change in the our culture's thinking, still a lot of men use women out of insecurity. And I remember a comment my dad made once, and he wasn't a real big bossy dad or anything, but my one sister was more analytical, and he said, she thinks like a man. And, you know, and I think often we think women do think in emotional, et cetera. And I grew up then using women because of my insecurity, I realize now. And after I came to Christ, I realized my attitude probably isn't too good about this. So God, I went through a lot of humility, actually, over a period of a couple, well, after I was a Christian, a couple years, and I realized that often women really conquest. And so the exciting was the chase. And once you had the capture or the won the relationship, well, then you'd want to move on. Well, then you get married, and more humility sets in. So I think a lot of men do use women out of their own insecurity, but wouldn't maybe not admit that.
I don't think there's any question about it. I think you're absolutely right. And we have to remember, too, these observations about women being more emotional thinkers than men. You know, there may be some truth in a generalized way about that, but what's the cause for that? Is it because of their biological makeup as women? Or is it because in Western culture, we think that's the way it should be? I believe the latter. I think it's because men are taught in our culture to be unemotional and to be tough guys. We're the ones that are taught not to cry. We're the ones that are taught that only a sissy expresses his feelings. If you go to other cultures, if you go to the Near East, for example, where the Bible was written, the men are tons more emotional than they are here. They weep and cry out, they hug each other, they're extremely emotional. But it's the Western male who has been taught to be very stoic, very tough, the kind of the British stiff upper lip idea, and that's masculine, and that being emotional is feminine. So these cultural norms are taught and modeled, and then it comes out in behavior in a general sort of way. And then people mistakenly conclude that that's a product of biology, when if we look at the broader context, it really doesn't look to be the case. And there is no teaching in the Bible, by the way. I've heard Christian authors say, well, the woman's more emotional and the man's more analytical. It never says anything like that in the Bible. You know, I've been so long-winded, I'd like to keep going, but we really are out of time. So I want to save a few minutes to pray together. And if you want to have at me a little more, I'll be up here afterwards. You can come up and get me here. Let's turn to God. Lord God, there's a lot to think about here. And we realize that there's also a lot of confusion on this, Lord. Help us as Christians to be communicators who can explain the true biblical view here, Lord, this idea of servant love, which is so much at the center of everything, your way not of trying to garnish power, but of giving up your power in order to be a servant and a lover of others. That's really the tone that we need to set in our lives, Lord, those of us men and women, that we become servants, that we become humble, that we become givers of love and not takers of love. Help us to imitate Jesus in this, Lord.
Lord, being a servant, we look at that as a daunting task. We see our inadequacies, and we thank you that your word reminds us that we aren't adequate, but but you empower us. I thank you so much for that, that you are the unfailing spring of life. And you even said that rivers of living water can flow from us because you supply that power and that love, Lord. So we thank you for that. As we sit here and recognize we can't really do that, that's the first response. And then to call on you for a relationship with you, and then the just a moment by moment empowering you provide. So we thank you for that, Lord.
Mm-hmm. I wanna thank you, God, that you are the original giver of everything, that
yes.
And that you model your service to us, and that you give us so much. You know, it's strange to me that you know, even though right now I'm in kind of a hurting time of my life, that when I want to turn to you and ask you for the resources to give, that they're there. Mm-hmm. And I just thank you that you give us so much when we open ourselves up to you, and we don't need to worry about hanging on to power or control because of the supply you offer.
That's right. Yes, Lord, I pray for any here today who may struggle with these concepts, Lord, and who may particularly feel like they're not sure whether they've ever personally invited you into their lives, Lord, that this is truly the key to beginning to understand a way of life that involves true humility with one another, self-giving love, and a new ability to relate to people at a deeper level, God. I pray that anyone in that position today who's not sure that they've ever invited you personally into their life will just do so right now, just saying, God, I realize I have to be forgiven. I want to know this personal relationship with you. Come into my life, please. We know that you'll answer that for everyone who prayed it today, God. In Christ's name, amen.